This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to bite into Nerds gummy clusters? They're fruity. They're tangy. They're gummy. And they're crunchy. Nerds gummy clusters, a union of fruity sweet gummy and tangy crunchy nerds. Unleash your senses. Shop now at nerdscandy.com.
A quick message before we go to this week's podcast that we have a very special reward for all our podcast listeners. On Wednesday, 18th of August, Jude Law multi-award winning actor known for his roles in Sherlock Holmes, The Talented Mr. Ripley and The Grand Budapest Hotel, among others, will be joining us for a live recording of the hit podcast How I Found My Voice. And you can join along for free and ask Jude your questions about his life and career. To do so, just click the link in our episode description or go to intelligencesquared.com/attend and use the promo code PODCAST, that's PODCAST, at the checkout to get your exclusive free access to our live recording with Jude Law. That's promo code PODCAST, PODCAST. But now on to this week's episode, where we were joined by James Griffiths, who all the way from Hong Kong spoke to Carl Miller about how China built and controls an alternative version of the internet. It's a really fascinating conversation, touching on Hong Kong, coronavirus, and how the Chinese model of controlling the internet is spreading to other parts of the world. And if you do enjoy it, you can find a link to pre-order the new version of James's book in the podcast description. But now, let's go to the episode.
Hello, and welcome to this Intelligence Squared podcast with me, Carl Miller. I'm delighted to welcome our guest today, James Griffiths, author and Asia correspondent for Globe and Mail, and author of The Great Firewall of China, How to Build and Control an Alternative Version of the Internet, which is out now. James, hello.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Right, James, before we talk about China, let's talk about the internet kind of before China. So take us back to those heady days when, you know, people like Vint Cerf were imagining what that network would look like. What was the original vision?
Well, as the internet kind of moved from being first a US military funded operation and then more of a scientific operation and became something closer to what we think of the internet today, facilitating communication around the world, letting people share anything they want, there was this libertarian dream, let's say, of the internet as breaking down borders, of letting people say whatever they wanted to whomever they wanted, and in a way that would not only work against government censorship and control, but would be impossible to censor or control, that this would just simply defeat any government efforts to do so.
And was that all then a kind of deliberate kind of architectural vision which they had? They knew that this was going to become the battleground which it's become. Is that right? And that they kind of wanted to kind of build in early defences against it?
Certainly, ideologically, the people were very opposed to censorship, and there was this big kind of free speech ethos within Silicon Valley and also in the European areas of development of the internet. But I wouldn't say from a technical perspective stuff was particularly built in. There was just this kind of assumption that in one of the old famous slogans was the internet would root around censorship, that just the nature of the tech that they were building would do this. But they didn't, I mean, from several generations down the line, we can see that they didn't actually put anything in place to prevent this from happening. But perhaps you could argue that they maybe thought they were.
Okay. So we have this early vision of the internet, decentralized, a bit chaotic, home of mind. I think you quoted John Perry Barlow, didn't you, in the opening of your book. When did alternative visions that were hostile to that initial conception begin to rise?
Yeah, so if as the internet began to evolve in China, and as it came to be introduced to the country, it followed a similar pattern to the US. This was mainly a thing that was being used by research institutions, scientists, universities. And then following, and it was, the government was paying attention to it in a way, but as a piece of new technology, not necessarily as a speech threat or as something that they desperately needed control. But then following the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989, you kind of see both sides of this debate, people pushing for greater freedoms in China and also the government, suddenly recognize the internet as a potential platform outside of government control. Dissidents who had fled overseas started to use email servers and rudimentary bulletin boards to get their messages back into China. And then the authorities responded by very quickly ramping up control over it and building kind of the first bricks of what we now call the Great Firewall.
And what did that kind of early vision look like then? Like, how long did it take for a kind of alternative, kind of counter kind of vision of the internet within China to become kind of clear?
Oh, not very long. I mean, this was pretty much as the internet was becoming a mass consumer product in China, it was also becoming a censored form of communications. There was never any point where it was available to the majority of people in an uncensored form. And from a technological perspective, that was very easy for the government to do because the way that it had been built in there was also, it was pretty much controlled top down by the government through various utilities. There were limited access points between the very, very rudimentary Chinese internet at the time and the global internet. So it was quite easy for them to go in and put in controls, put in filters and firewalls and start censoring stuff. Though, obviously, in the early days, that was a very unsophisticated process that they were using.
All right. Well, we've opened Pandora's box. You've mentioned filters and firewalls, so I guess we're going to have to kind of dip our toe into something that's kind of technical aspects of this just for a second to understand what the firewall really is. So could you kind of take us through then the kind of different kind of composite parts, I guess, which kind of add up to the Chinese vision?
Yeah, I think it's better to think of it in a way that this is something that's evolved in a cat and mouse game with people trying to beat the censors. That as those efforts have got more sophisticated or they've just changed over time, the censors have had to come up with new ways of preventing them. So in the beginning, the Great Firewall was very similar to any firewall that probably pretty much anyone listening will have had some kind of experience with, either at an office or at school, that, you know, that blocks certain websites. You know, it was essentially a porn filter for a long time in China. And then as the internet started to be used for more political purposes, you start seeing more and more political websites added. But then as people started to realize that things were getting blocked, and they worked to get around those blocks by having tons and tons of mirrors of websites, by using proxy servers to get through the original blacklist, then the firewall starts to get more sophisticated. You have this thing called deep packet inspection, which can look not just at the websites and the IP addresses that are being accessed, but also the content of those sites. So it can either flag things for review, or potentially if something sets off enough alarms, just block it entirely. And that's got more and more sophisticated over time and has evolved through a huge amount of investment and work by Beijing and also by private Chinese companies or semi-private Chinese companies, with artificial intelligence, with reams and reams of human programmers looking at things and working out better ways to improve block lists and blacklists. And it's just become a much more sophisticated thing that can most of the time control, and or let's say it can control enough of the information enough of the time to make internet and speech on the internet far less of a threat to Beijing.
And adding all these things up together, so, you know, some filters over there and some censorship over there and some deep packet inspection over there, I mean, did this all amount to something which really is kind of a re-engineering of what the internet really is?
No, and I think that's what takes us back to the idea that these libertarian information wants to be free thinkers of the early stage of the internet didn't really put in particularly good protections for speech. You know, the short of the political pressures against doing so in countries like the UK or the US, you could introduce the Great Firewall in pretty much any country. You know, it would be a political decision to do so, and politics is what would stop it, or, you know, legal protections we have for speech and things like that. But technologically, it's not too difficult to do. You know, it takes a lot of investment to do it at the scale that China is doing it, certainly, but it's not overly sophisticated.
So how much kind of resistance then did China really face as it began to, in the kind of post-Tiananmen era, like implement all of these different kinds of forms of control?
Within China, obviously not a huge amount of resistance, because this is a one-party authoritarian state, which has a number of levers of control against people that try to work against it.
Always helpful.
Outside of the country, you did see various groups of activists, of dissidents. The Falun Gong religious movement was a major kind of proponent of anti-censorship technology for a long time after the Chinese government cracked down on them, because they saw this as, you know, a key way to continue to proselytize inside China. You know, large, in kind of, say, the last decade or so, it's become more the realm of programmers and of people trying to find a technological solution to this, who come at this from maybe more of a pure tech background than a lot of the early people who were political dissidents, who kind of were forced to try and find ways around censorship because otherwise they couldn't get anyone to read what they were saying or hear what they're saying. But, you know, this has always gone up against a huge party state, which has incredible amount of money and resources to throw at this. And also, since the evolution of the kind of Chinese commercial internet, and we start to see huge social media companies like Weibo, like WeChat, and Baidu as a search engine, you know, since these big internet firms, Chinese internet firms have come up, they also are pressured by the government to invest a huge amount of money in censorship and in controlling what people are saying and in monitoring what people are saying. So you have this, you know, public-private partnership working against, say, you know, a scattered group of dissidents and activists around the world who have, you know, have fought a very good and long fight against the censors in Beijing, but it's one that is very, very difficult for them to ever win in the long term.
So let's step away just from our rough chronology for a second, because I do want to talk about this scattered group, as you call them. So I've been to one of the Internet Governance Forum meetings, for anyone listening who has never heard of it, which will probably be almost everybody. It's a kind of strange crossroads where, you know, big tech and activists and think tank researchers and so on all meet usually once a year in non-coronavirus times to kind of talk about all these issues. One thing that struck me, James, when I went there was that all these discussions around internet regulation and protocols and blocking and censoring was both so utterly fundamental to the lives that we live, but also so kind of impenetrable and technical and, in a sense, boring, if you will, for most people, that it was always very, very difficult for these things to kind of break out and become kind of popular political topics. Like, is this something that you think has kind of dogged the world of internet governance, the way that it is very difficult to kind of try and translate these things into issues which most people would care about?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, internet activists have complained about this for a long time, that there is internet governance as a kind of broad issue is done both kind of through governments interacting with internet companies within their borders, but also obviously internationally and supranationally. And it's very, very difficult. Like you said, it's complex. It's pretty boring. It's technical. It's not necessarily always easy either to, even when there is a real threat to speech coming down from that kind of multinational, you know, international level, to explain to people how this could affect them, you know, in their personal lives in Europe or in the US, or, you know, let alone in an authoritarian country. I talk a bit in my book about this kind of quite prominent fight that's been going on for about two decades now between what is called the multi-stakeholder model and the multilateral model, which, you know, the fact that those two words how we call the both sides shows how technical and boring this all can be and why it's hard to get people interested in. But multi-stakeholder basically means you have companies and activist groups and NGOs involved, as well as governments, and multilateral means you just have the governments, which is what, you know, your authoritarian countries that are controlling the internet, like China and Russia and other states, would much rather have, because it gives them way more leverage and it gives them more standing. And it's often very hard that when you have these internet freedom groups, you have anti-censorship organizations, when they're trying to alert people to any shift away from the multi-stakeholder model, for them to sell that to people as something they really need to be concerned about. You know, think about how hard it is to get people concerned about things that happen at the United Nations at the best of times, let alone when it's a subsidiary body of the United Nations dealing with the technical matters of how we assign IP addresses around the world. You know, this is an incredibly difficult thing to sell people on, even though it's governing technology which we use every second of our day and which is hugely important to freedom of speech around the world.
And we would notice the moment any profound or important change happened to shift the internet away from what we're used to as well, I guess, which is...
I think one good example I would say actually is especially for people in Europe listening, that if you think about the GDPR, the European Privacy Bill, that a lot of people were not aware of this thing that had been ticking along at a European level for ages before it came into force, and suddenly every single website in the world was asking them, can I take your personal information to keep serving you this website? And if you think about that there are proposals far more negative than GDPR, not to suggest that GDPR is negative, that are being made at bodies that people are paying even less attention to than the European Parliament or European bodies, and the worst case scenario that the internet freedom groups will kind of paint out is that one of those proposals gets through a body like the International Telecommunications Union, which is governed by the UN, and suddenly a lot of the kind of things we take for granted in terms of protecting speech online or governing how websites are work around the world could suddenly be very fundamentally changed.
China then is not only implementing a series of kind of technical network level stuff happening on their own border. Are they also kind of waging what's the best way of describing it, James? A kind of regulatory war, like within the UN and other bodies?
Yeah, absolutely. So as the firewall became very, very secure and you know was essentially unassailable from within China itself, and as I think the censors realized that a lot of the problem was coming from overseas, and also this coincides with China generally engaging more in the international community, especially the UN, there has been a concerted effort by China in concert with Russia and a couple of other countries to reduce protections for speech in global internet governance, to give governments more power to control all aspects of internet technology and kind of business within their borders. And I would say that a lot of this is mainly about shoring up the firewall and giving the censors more powers over the Chinese internet. But the effect it has is undermining protections, maybe not so much in democratic countries that where we would hope that our own governments would give those protections to us anyway, but certainly in countries that are semi-democratic or authoritarian that maybe don't have the same tech built in already as China, but it gives them coverage to do so in future or gives them potentially a model for following along the Chinese path.
So I think this brings us to one of the key pivots which you point to, which is this kind of shift from China both first trying to kind of look within and control the internet within, and now kind of turning its kind of gaze to try and understand and control the internet outside of its borders as well. I think that's one of the key pivots. So let's dwell on that for a moment. In a nutshell, how is China, what would be the Chinese vision of our internet now? Like what do they want our internet to look like?
If it's just us talking to us, they don't care too much. But if it's anything that impacts China, there is a new attention to this and a desire to control this in a way that did not exist, say, 15 years ago. It was once felt that either there was a sense that this was just not something you could control, say how people organize against Beijing in Washington or Berlin or London, that this wasn't something that Beijing could try and influence, or there was a sense that it wasn't something that maybe Beijing should care about because ultimately it didn't affect the security situation too much within China itself. And that viewpoint has completely shifted to there is an effort both through lobbying of various governments around the world to kind of take a harder line on anti-China operations in them, to pressuring companies to kind of conform to what we might call Chinese political correctness, Chinese state-backed hackers going after dissident groups overseas and after governments critical of China, you know, the export of Chinese tech to various allied countries in a way that kind of improves China's standing in terms of controlling their security situation. Beijing is not satisfied to stand by while the internet is used or any form of communication is used to malign Beijing or hurt its interests, no matter where the person doing that might be around the world.
So that for activists and authors, I mean, for people like you, I guess, as well, James, you know, who write a lot about China and its politics, this must be extremely worrying time to kind of see whether China will actually have some success in terms of stifling or chilling speech outside of its borders.
Yeah, and we've already seen this, you know, pretty much every year there is, you know, from very kind of basic levels of academic conferences being pressured to cancel certain guests or drop certain topics. The Tibetan exile community in particular, now increasingly as well, the Uyghur exile community have come under huge pressure from, you know, being harassed online and also being targeted by hackers and having their communications spied on. And that does chill speech because, you know, it really raises the potential costs of speaking out even when you've fled China, let alone for people who are still within Greater China or still based in China themselves. You know, it really, the hand of the state, or the sense that the hand of the state can reach anywhere in the world is you know, is far more palpable.
So you've mentioned hackers several times now, state-based hackers. So are they part of then this kind of Chinese vision or Chinese model? So you've got kind of sensors and filters happening internally, but then also this ability to kind of reach out, I guess, as a kind of and to exert state power via the internet externally as well. And I guess Chinese influence operations or information warfare would come under that banner too.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really part of that shift from just seeing, if you just saw the Great Firewall originally as more of a defensive model and more of a domestically focused thing about shoring up the Chinese internet and separating it from the rest of the world and filtering what comes through to it, that now you see from behind that firewall, influence operations being launched in Taiwan, in Hong Kong, you know, in Europe, in the US, and also concerted hacking of, you know, not only kind of traditional intelligence targets, but also activist groups, dissidents, exiles, and you know, that's something that really has changed, and that's something which really also then, I think it then kind of doubles the effectiveness of the firewall itself because not only do you block these people from, not only do you block whatever these people has been put out from getting back into China, but also you in some instances manage to stop them from speaking out altogether.
We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared.
If we go back to the early vision of the internet, I know that one of the things that its early creators wanted to have happen was the emergence of all these communities online, which would have no necessary relationship with any geographic place. And I guess, like, you know, we still see that, don't we? We still see online communities that are brought together for completely ageographic reasons. And perhaps more than any other is Wikipedia and the kind of open knowledge, open source communities which cluster around it. What is their future in a world where states with the kind of capability and time horizons as China might begin to think you are engaged in an activity which is profoundly unsettling and desecuritizing to us?
That's a good question. I would argue that probably Wikipedia is not at too much risk given its size and the apolitical nature of it, and that it wouldn't, I don't think it would necessarily be such a target, because this is always already blocked in China, and you know, Wikipedia isn't going out of its way to get past those blocks or to try and undermine them or to lobby against them and stuff. You know, you generally do have to take an extra step to earn that kind of attention. But what's, I think, more pernicious is that this model of the internet that China has is spreading around the world, and so that while Wikipedia and other open source communities or other open flows of information may continue to be available in the US or the UK and various countries, similar countries, that as more and more nations adopt a Chinese approach to the internet and control it a lot more, they will start to cut off these open platforms themselves, because from similar desire to have control and to censor what people are able to read.
So where is China having that success then, James, in terms of exporting the model?
All over the place. Most any authoritarian leaning country that is allied with Beijing has at this point started to buy up tech from Chinese companies. You know, we've seen in particular parts of Africa. I talk about Uganda in my book, which is a country that has kind of pursued an aggressively anti-internet freedom approach in recent years, blacking out the internet and also investing in kind of Chinese filtering tech and surveillance tech. We've seen Russia, which has never been a great fan of an open and free internet, that's shifted from its kind of own take on internet censorship in much more of a Chinese direction. The way that they've been approaching it legally, the way they've been approaching it technically, is far more Chinese in practice, and is happening with the assistance of Chinese officials and tech companies. And we've also seen a lot of places in Asia. Cambodia is in the midst of introducing something that is basically a Cambodian version of the Great Firewall, Vietnam as well. And China is basically ready and willing. If any country comes to it and says, hey, we want to control our internet, China is happy to provide both the technical expertise and from a legal basis of kind of helping to draft laws which can clamp down on speech online. And you know, the Vietnamese cybersecurity law is, you know, almost word for word that which China passed previously.
And is the idea there to basically establish this kind of state-centric control of the internet as a new norm globally?
Yes, absolutely. And this is a helpful service that Beijing can provide its allies, and it shores up any effort by Beijing at the international level to promote its vision of the internet, because it has a bunch of people that are fully on board with that vision and will be ready to support it against the US or the EU or whoever is trying to push for a more open one.
And I guess this brings us to a word which we surprisingly haven't used yet, the splinternet. So, you know, this fissure of legal and technical distinction between internets reaching such a point where they might not even interoperate anymore. How is that a future you see, James? Is the splinternet happening?
Yeah, the splinternet's a bit of a fuzzy term because it's very easy to define it in a way that says that it's already been happening for a long time. You know, arguably since at least when Beijing started developing the Great Firewall and set a big filter between it and the rest of the world, that you already have two versions of the internet. But yeah, this is definitely something which is advancing, the existence of the firewall and the success of the firewall and the success of China's domestic internet, not just in terms of censoring information, but also from a kind of business standpoint, and there are alternative Chinese services to much of the blocked ones. That really emboldened a lot of countries that I think in the past would have believed that they were too small to censor their own internets, or that this was kind of a Faustian bargain they had to make to get the benefits economically of the internet. They kind of had to take the maybe speech that they didn't like being spread in their countries. And now they're seeing that there is this alternative model that China is advancing and that China will help you achieve. And we are going to see more countries move towards that. And maybe on the converse of that, we might see democratic countries shift away from it, particularly amid concerns about influence operations and hacking and various other cybersecurity concerns.
Okay, well, let's bring this all together. So, you know, internal control, external influence, state-based hackers, influence operations, exporting models, to try and understand some of the kind of contemporary flashpoints which we're faced with now. So, first off, coronavirus. Of course, huge global conversations happening around its cause, consequences, and so on. Have you seen the kind of the Great Firewall and its kind of other orbiting capabilities kind of being deployed to try and protect China from coronavirus conversations, or of course extend its kind of message and influence elsewhere?
Absolutely, and it's useful to think of this in kind of two main stages that both of which have kind of been detrimental to the global conversation, but also potentially to even really exacerbating the spread of coronavirus. So in the very early weeks and months, that as information was starting to come out of Wuhan that there was a virus circulating, that as concern was building that this was something similar to SARS, as doctors were starting to raise the alarm, they were pretty aggressively censored on the Chinese internet. Chinese state media even reported on police, you know, cracking down on rumor mongers who actually turned out to have just been sharing completely accurate information from a medical perspective, and that could have stopped people from you know, receiving information that might have made them act differently, could have prevented information getting back from Wuhan to Beijing in a clean way that might have made the central government authorities react more quickly. And so you really see how censorship was detrimental, you know, not just to political speech not just anti-government activity, but really, you know, it was detrimental to doctors and health workers being able to raise the alarm about a potential epidemic and which became a pandemic. And that we'll never really know how that might have played out if, when a doctor raised the alarm in Wuhan, he could have gone straight to a newspaper and told them and been on front pages. We'll never know what effect that might have had on how the virus developed in and how it spread in the early months of the pandemic. So in the second, so obviously this the China's handling of the coronavirus has been greatly criticized, and the kind of second, the outward bound, let's say, version of the firewall or the section of the firewall and, you know, the umbrella internet censorship and control in China, we've seen that kick into action when it comes to shaping the narrative globally around, you know, any kind of responsibility people might believe China has for how the pandemic developed, for pushing very, very aggressively pushing conspiracy theories about US biochemical lab, for sharing disinformation about vaccines for a long time, which we saw happening through state media, through state-controlled outlets. And so you see how the kind of propaganda side of this has also damaged the conversation around coronavirus, as well as the censorship side damaged our original knowledge of it within China itself.
So James, that was coronavirus. And I guess in Hong Kong, we've got something a bit different, which is perhaps, you know, this city which suddenly is moving from the external internet to the Chinese internet.
Yeah, absolutely. And this has happened incredibly quickly. I think that my book first came out in 2019. And I think if you'd asked me at the time, was Hong Kong in imminent danger of kind of going under the Great Firewall, I'd have confidently said no, and said this was still, you know, years off, if not even potentially decades off. And yet since the passage in 2020 of the national security law in Hong Kong, which has had a huge effect on people's ability to speak freely here, on political groups active in the city, it is not out of the bounds of possibility that we will see far, far more censorship of websites online here. You know, it's still something of a transitional phase because a lot of the organizations and a lot of the speech being cracked down upon is happening within Hong Kong. But as that happens, and as more and more people flee overseas, and you start to see the kind of center of conversation around Hong Kong political activism become moved to the diaspora, as we saw with kind of Uyghurs, with Tibetans in the past, I think it's much more foreseeable that the government will start to find it wants to block certain websites or it wants to block certain services. And, you know, that's something that happens very quickly, because once you block something, you then have to decide, well, do I want to block every way that people use to get around this as well? And you suddenly find yourself with a very long list of things to block, and then you need to improve your technological capabilities to do so. And you very quickly get to the point where you need a system like the Great Firewall to do that.
James, final question. For all the people listening to this, I'm going to guess that this discussion has both felt very close and very far away at the same time. You know, close in the sense that we're talking about technologies that people are literally using at the moment to listen to this. Very far away in that we've also been talking about raging regulatory wars within the ITU and the optic fiber cable based blockers. And, you know, as we said, as we were talking about in the middle, you know, the all these like rumbling competitions over power really happening in ways which are very, very obscure and highly technical in many ways, and very difficult for just, you know, mass political mobilization or even consciousness, I suppose. Is there anything that, what can people do? What can people do to kind of draw themselves a little closer to discussions about internet regulation or discussions about protocols or discussions about censorship laws, to kind of try and make this just a little less foreign as an issue, and as an issue, I guess, an issue set in the years ahead as it inevitably heats up?
Yeah, I think people, you know, people should be advised to pay more attention to this stuff. That when we have conversations around encryption, when we have conversations around internet freedom and people's ability to say things online, or, you know, even when it comes to things like extremist content or very negative content being shared online, that people need to pay attention to that, because that's where you get this kind of slippage into governments taking greater controls, into security services taking, you know, increasing their abilities to surveil people. And, you know, and essentially, if you see the Great Firewall as a kind of lodestar for authoritarian leaning governments as a model to build their internet on, you know, the kind of counter to that would be for democratic governments and for free societies to build an ideal version of the internet, which, you know, is not only free of censorship, but actively increases people's freedom online. So not only from government's controls and surveillance, but also private industry, from corporations snooping on what we do. And you know, it is one of those things that you can build, not to sound hippy dippy, but you can build a better version of the internet at home, and that could spread in a way that this negative version of the internet is being spread by China.
Well, James, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you. That was a great discussion on genuinely one of the most important topics I think currently faces us in the world of technology. The book, which I genuinely urge people listening to this to take a look at, is The Great Firewall of China. I've been Carmilla, and you've been listening to Intelligence Squared.